All right, happy Saturday, everyone. This is going to be a big, big hour. Literally, one of the most revered fishermen on the planet is going to join us. We'll chat with Nomad Lures founder and pioneer Damon Olson in just a few minutes. But I got to get this story first. A Bite Me Fishing Show love story?
I had a couple little lovebirds on my boat last week.
Oh, really?
I did. Mm-hmm. Boyfriend, girlfriend. Been together about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And they became a couple because of Bite Me.
Get out.
Check it out, dude. Check it out. Yeah.
A Bite Me love story?
A Bite Me love story.
Like Hallmark.
And actually somewhat normal people, too, believe it or not.
Well, that's even more shocking.
No, they work together, and a girl comes walking in the room, and old boy's listening to Bite Me. And she says, what you listening to there? And he said, Bite Me is a fishing show. And she said, well, I just got back. I think she said Big Shell or something, a fishing destination. Mm-hmm. I just got back from there. I think I want to listen to it. And that became their thing. They listened to Bite Me together. And then, you know, I hand out some pretty solid marriage tips from time to time. And, you know, I guess one thing led to another. And pretty cool little couple, too. Good. Well, folks.
Just give us their first names.
It was Gabriel and Ryan.
Gabriel and Ryan. How about that?
Yep. I'll let y'all decide.
Gabriel could be the male or the female.
I didn't need to park off in his wine since noon to get into the comments.
Well, here's the thing. I want to dig in on this real quick. I am a licensed minister. Mm-hmm. I can marry people.
Ooh. Do you hear that, Ryan?
Ryan, Gabriel. So Ryan's the dude?
No, Ryan's the chick, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, I see. They both have names that can go either way.
That's why I said something earlier. But yeah,
yeah. So I'm an ordained minister.
There you go.
I can marry y'all at Feeding Frenzy 2026.
Dean can DJ DJ the first dance. I'm not sure what my role is going to be in there. I could be marriage counselor. No, they need to sit down with me. It's a mandatory 2-hour session before the ceremony to make sure that they're right for each other. And
yeah,
like, we can get in touch with our deep feelings and talk. they're not worth a damn at attracting redfish to the boat, but they might attract a crowd at the fundraiser thingamadigger.
They're good looking people.
Ryan is remarkably better looking than Gabriel.
Remarkably,
yeah. Remarkably. No, I mean, good looking couple, and I love Gabe. They're both surgeons, which I thought was super cool. They're both doctors. Gabriel's a surgeon. I don't know if I can say it out loud. He's a trauma surgeon, and so the first thing I went was, "What have you dug out of people's butts?" And the list is crazy.
One in a million chance, Doc.
From what I gathered, Ryan is like the hospital doctor type. Mm-hmm. I was too busy quizzing Gabriel to really get too deep into what Ryan
knows. Yeah.
And Gabriel was, he's like oil field in West Texas. One day he said, screw it, I'm going to be a surgeon. I was like, well, that's a story you don't hear every day.
See, that could have been Dean.
Sherman said, y'all just proposed for poor Gabriel. You know, this super cool.
And look, we barely know these people, and we've got
we don't even know
business
these
already. We got them married. We got them already in counseling. Yeah. We know about things he dug out of people's butt.
Well, yeah, no, and I may have already done this already because I've got a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things I won't say, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
no, there's
since
not.
When
we're sitting there talking, yeah. And Ryan informs me that she had to like force Gabriel to like. They go out on a date and Gabriel try to like stay in the friend zone and she had to be like, hey, stupid, get out of the friend zone. I was like, yeah, stupid. What are you thinking? he said, well, I'm just trying to keep her professional. I said, that's a stupid idea. I'd quit my job.
Keep it professional.
You should quit your job and date this girl, you dumbass.
That's some advanced counseling right there, man.
I'm telling you, I think I should do it.
Level.
So here's where we are. You could do Feeding Frenzy 2026. Mm-hmm. We'll already be paying for the tables.
That's right.
There's already going to be a tables and chairs.
There's going to be food there already.
We'll get a cake.
And if the wedding party is part of the first 200 people, they eat for free.
Talking about.
We'll have a DJ, DJ and Matt.
And after they get married, we'll send their ass on a dolphin watching trip. Yeah. Which
But Steve could be the ring bearer. Steve could be the ring bearer.
Oh, dude, Steve and Ryan, man, they peas and carrots. Steve hung out with her all day long. I told her, I said, he just buttering your ass up to get you to do what he wants. He don't really care if you're his friend or not. She didn't believe me.
And but I can officiate.
Telling you, this is an idea.
This is an idea. the only problem is we don't know where Gabriel and Ryan land on this idea.
I tell you what, let's send them on the fishing trip, because I'm going to be honest. The day we had fishing sucked. The fish would not eat. So we're going to send them on the fishing trip.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll just get drunk and go watch dolphins.
Well, they got to win. We got to be fair. We got to be fair about that. Dude, I can't believe you didn't send me this. This is perfect. This is a bite me love story. It's like a Hallmark movie. You know, she used to own a bookstore in some little town, or she owns a bookstore in some little town. He's the surgeon that we used to be, an oil field worker. A little gruff around the edges. They were in the friend zone for too long. Dude, this is Hallmark.
If you want to know how to hook up with a super cool chick that is also a doctor, mm-hmm. listen to Bite Me. That's all it takes.
Yeah.
It's simple.
Mm-hmm.
I gave the only people too. It's just only natural for me to compliment the chick more, because it'd be kind of weird if I was like, how awesome Gabriel. Gabriel's a good dude. I like Gabriel.
They could have a destination wedding in Aransas Pass.
That's the only hitch. Where'd y'all get married? Aransas Pass. It's all right.
Here's what I want to know. Gabriel, text me when this happens, because I want to know if you suffered through all of this on speakerphone while at work with people listening.
Gabriel has already been texted 10 times.
No, I haven't.
From the people listening.
Oh, yeah, people. Yeah, yeah. No, I didn't warn him at all.
No, he's been texted about 10 times.
He might be up in somebody's anus at the moment.
It's going to be weird.
What if I told him, dude, I don't know, man, being married is a real pain in the ass. And he's like, means nothing to me, dog. I got that.
Sherman says he's going to be wearing white shrimper boots down the aisle.
Yeah.
Yes. I can see it now.
Yeah. All right. So that was great. I'm glad you brought that up.
I got a tip.
You got one too?
For today.
Mm-hmm.
It's a boat maintenance tip, but you know, anybody who owns a boat maybe can learn a lesson from my misfortune.
What happened?
So apparently, outboard motors have super high oil pressure. They have higher, like normal, way more than a car. So aftermarket oil filters and such like that are really not recommended for that. Also, having the proper tools to install an outboard oil filter is critical, because if you tighten it with channel locks and it gets a little nick mm-hmm. or a kink in the sheet metal that is the outer casing of the oil filter, it will blow out a hole right there, and it will pump all of the oil out of your motor into the cowling of the engine.
How do you know this?
I witnessed it.
Where'd you witness it?
Out the back of my boat.
You turned around?
Yes. So for those do-it-yourselfer kind of people out there, when it comes to oil change in time, use a proper oil filter wrench to tighten the oil filter to its manufactured specifications.
I've done that exact thing. And like the bottom of the cowling, where all those little like puddles are.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Crap, it's hard to get oil out of them.
And so through all of that, I disassembled all of the cowling, the side panels. And I went at it with Don. So I disassembled the whole thing out here in the driveway. I even had an oil ring around the back of my boat from when I pulled in at the last minute. As I was I put the thing on the trailer, mm-hmm. and yes, I left crazy slippery ring around the whole back of my boat. And then apparently oil attracts sand and mm-hmm. And mud, and everywhere that the mud and such touch the oil, it just turns into like this disaster of scratchy paste.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. it has a thing. So for hopefully that saves somebody some
Jeff Gonzo says you got to clean the seagulls.
Hopefully that little tip will prevent. And it was spraying out that hole. So I was actually probably about, man, shoot, 7 or 8 miles from the boat ramp where it started. Man. And when I looked at it, I was like, man, it's like, I don't know if I'm going to get this thing back. I said, we'll see how far it goes before the alarm goes off. Mm-hmm. And through all of that running and that oil, I was still only 2 quarts low. So it really didn't, I mean, it didn't spew that much out, and it made it all the way back to the marina. Alarms never went off. And at the end, even after I changed the filter, the oil that came out of the filter, it only took 2 quarts to bring it back up to the level. But when you spray a fine mist of 2 quarts of oil over a wide area, it doesn't obviously take that much to make quite a disaster.
And all these fishermen on the bay were like, hey, look, another slick.
Yeah. I probably had a trail of them behind me out there throwing for speckled trout.
Amazing. All right. Coming up, it's time for Geared Up, and I know you're going to enjoy it. It's the science and technology behind lures. Damon Olson, legendary fisherman, joins us next. All right, really been looking forward to this. It's time for Geared Up, brought to us every week by Anglers Anonymous, which a couple of things real quick. I checked with Mike Butler over at Anglers Anonymous this week about the feeding frenzy, and in typical Mike Butler fashion, he just said, yes, what do you need? Yes, we're all about the Bite Me podcast and all about the organizations it benefits. Of course, Heroes on the Water in Texas, Boys Outdoors. So he answered yes. He's hopping on with a sponsorship for the event and a bunch of stuff for the raffles and silent auctions. It's just fantastic. Go see my guys over there. All right, I've been waiting on this one. We always have some great guests here on the Bite Me Fishing Show, Bite Me Podcast. And if you recall, Nomad and Live Ops Lures now are a great partner and friend of the Bite Me Fishing Show. But well before that, I like to say, and I did a video on this earlier, you know, unpaid endorsement, because I got some of the soft plastics here. Of course, we're joined by Damon Olson, the founder, inventor, expert, everything of Nomad Lures. And we're going to get that story in a minute. But I took these babies out and I tried 3 plastics, and we'll get to this specifically, Damon, in just a minute. I did the Spectre plastic. And then I did the 5-inch dozer.
Yep.
And then on a whim, I did the jerk squid. I said, well, let me try this jerk squid. Never caught anything on an artificial squid in our fishing, you know, Gulf Coast bay fishing. I've done it offshore, but never caught. And man, did I kill it. And I went and immediately said, well, I got to do a video on this. I got to do a video on this. So before we go there, Damon, your history, if I'm correct on this, you actually are a captain, a licensed captain, correct?
Yeah, that was how I started out. Well, I guess prior to that, I was at university as a civil engineer, worked as a civil engineer for a couple of years, and then went fishing. That's probably it in a nutshell. a lot of water passed under the bridge there. But yeah, I set up, and the charter operation in Australia was kind of what started all of the tackle. So that's kind of a, you know, there's obviously a fair story in all of that. So I'll let you ask questions, because if you let me go, I'll just keep talking.
No, we want you to go. Nobody wants to hear me, because every time I was familiar with the Nomad, I thought offshore, Nomad, you know, big baits, big fish, tuna, everything. So tell us how that part started, and then we'll get into what made you think, maybe we can do some soft plastics here.
Yeah, well, look, I guess my history, I mean, in Australia, it's a fundamentally different fishery that you grow up in. So we, you know, sort of grow up, and it's not a case of saltwater, freshwater. It's like you're doing everything as a kid. I've obviously been fishing since I was, you know, very young. But, you know, we'll go and catch like our version of a freshwater bass, and then the next weekend you might be, you know, offshore fishing or whatever. So the variety of fishing conditions that you sort of experience growing up in Australia is quite diverse. But the, you know, the charter operation obviously started, you know, growing up as a kid, I was always looking offshore. We've got this amazing, you know, Barrier Reef, the Coral Seas, all this kind of, you know, adventure awaiting offshore. And I think looking back on it now, it was probably the, you know, the adventure of trying to go and fish these really remote, amazing places that kind of started the whole charter operation. But, you know, we started out running a smaller boat in a place called Hervey Bay, Fraser Island, which is about 4 or 5 hours north of where I live at the moment. Mm-hmm. And great fishing. Anyway, that sort of went on for about 3 or 4 years, but the weather in that area made it really hard to fish. And, you know, short story is we'd done that for a while, and then we looked to set up this mothership operation. So it was a 85-foot aluminium sort of custom-built catamaran mothership. Nice. So kind of built that up in a place called Cairns in Queensland. So that was part of this operation to be able to fly people out to this remote area in the Coral Sea using mm-hmm. a seaplane. So it was an interesting setup, but we'd done a trip out to one of these reefs on the smaller, you know, charter boat that we had at the time, and mm-hmm. realized, you know, these reefs out in the Coral Sea were just incredible, like literally untouched, like nobody goes there. It's mm-hmm. you know, they're 200-300 miles offshore. They're hard to access, and we realized, like, hey, if we could actually, you know, fly people out there, because no one wants to do the boat trip out there. It takes forever. Yeah. It's a long way. So we, you know, long story with the background there, but we had to actually build this mothership with jet fuel storage in the mothership. So that was like, it was quite an involved
process. You're sicker than I am. Go ahead.
Yeah. Definitely. Well, it was a funny story. The guy by the name of Peter Gash, who was running the seaplane, and the first time I called him up, I think he just thought I was, well, he told me later, he's like, oh, I just thought you're another nutcase ringing up about trying to, you know, fly out to the middle of the ocean. He's like, yeah, I get these random phone calls every now and then, people ring up asking me to, like, fly them out to the middle of the ocean on a float plane, but no one ever actually does it. And then I was ringing him up trying to ask about, well, how much fuel do we need to store if we're going to go out here? How big do these tanks need to be? And anyway, it ended up happening, and, you know, we ran flights out there for many years, as it turned out. But that's kind of where the whole charter, you know, the charter operation started out there in the Coral Sea. You know, with Great Barrier Reef, the diversity of fishing out there, I guess I just feel very fortunate to have, you know, grown up here and been able to spend time out there, because it's an incredible fishery, and there's just so much diversity of species, and so, you know, the fishing is just so prolific out there that you get to experience a lot in, you know, a relatively short amount of time. And I guess from a, you know, from a sort of lure perspective and a you know, fishing perspective, mm-hmm. that charter operation, I suppose the other thing that's relevant for the US audience is, you know, unlike a lot of charter operations that probably run in other places, that we were primarily just artificial lures only. So we were, you know, casting for giant trevally, dogtooth tuna. So it basically was casting and trolling lures was mm-hmm. pretty much the only thing that we did for essentially 20 years that charter operation ended up running for. And we had, I think it was about 50 different countries. We had people from about 50-odd countries over that time that came from all over the world. I think we ended up, you know, there was like 35 different TV shows that we ended up hosting out there. It was like, you know, we had Spanish Fly, like all, you know, a lot of the, you know, local mm-hmm. knowledge, Ali, all these sort of guys come out. And it was a pretty fun time, to be honest. It was a great adventure for a, you know, a young guy that was mad keen on fishing. But I think, like I said before, looking back on it, I think the whole charter operation got set up just to kind of satisfy my sense of adventure, and you know, I wanted to go and fish these places, and I realized, well, the only way I can really go out there and, you know, access these places is kind of set up a charter operation and you know, help get people coming out to, you know, pay for the adventure.
where were you in 2000 when I was catching cod off of Surfer's Paradise, man? I could have used that.
I would have been just probably about 2 hours north of that on the Sunshine Coast. So I was 2000. I think I finished university in 1999, and yeah, then 2000. Well, there was this like prior to the charter operation, that period in around 2000 to 2003, there was this incredible billfish bite in that period of time off Sunshine Coast. So we were. You know, involved in Sunshine Coast Game Fishing Club. Yeah. I think it was 1 year we were the, you know, leading tag and release boat in Australia, that, you know, when we were tag and release. So sailfish, small black marlin, blue marlin, striped marlin, did that for a lot of years. But, you know, I think there was one year might have been about 450
holy fish tagged
and released. Yeah, it was like, I mean, that went on for years. So, again, yeah, like the exposure to catching a lot of fish in a short amount of time, that really helped, obviously, you know, learn a lot.
So what about the light bulb moment, I got to build some lures?
Yeah, well, that's probably jumping forwards to – it's probably sometime around – 2009 or 10. So we'd been running the charter operation out in the Coral Sea. And, you know, I guess it was, you know, I was going fairly well, but I was looking ahead to, all right, well, we're getting some brand exposure here. You know, mm-hmm. people are starting to know what Nomad is, charter operation. You know, we looked at either expanding the charter operation. And I'd always, you know, like I said, sort of engineering background, I'd always been interested in, you know, lures and making things and all the rest of it. But, I think around about 2009 or 10 was the time it was like, you know what, I think we should seriously look at making lures. And at the same time, so it probably wasn't one of those things I just woke up one day and said, oh, you know what, I'm going to do this time. It kind of happened over a period of time. I thought about, okay, getting into, you know, fishing tackle would be interesting because mm-hmm. as part of the charter operation, we'd already been bringing in a lot of our own tackle from, you know, places in Asia, either, you know, Japan, there was, you know, a lot of stuff out of Singapore, but there wasn't the tackle that we actually needed for the charter operation wasn't really available in mm-hmm. Australia. You know, a lot of it had to get, you know, sourced and brought in. So I'd started, you know, dealing with tackle through the charter operation. And mm-hmm. I guess, you know, one of the other key things to point out from this charter operation was the whole time we were running it as a guide, and a lot of the lures that we're using, it's all like surface casting. So as a guide, you're spending 10, 12 hours a day on the water just watching lures and, mm-hmm. you know, watching how fish react to certain retrieves and actions. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, the lure side of things, it was an interesting story. So Doug Olander from Sport Fishing Magazine, mm-hmm. I'd known him from the charter operation, and he ended up bringing out Patrick Sabeel. So I ended up getting to know Patrick, and we ended up doing a few trips together. We ended up actually distributing Sabeel lures in Australia many, many years ago, prior to the whole buyout and all the rest of it. That was kind of our early exposure into fishing tackle. And then from there, it was, okay, let's look to kind of manufacture our own.
Yeah, let's get to that and intricate things that separate game-changing lures from others. Specifically, we'll get into soft plastics next, right here on Sports Radio 610. Okay, welcome back to the Bite Me Fishing Show. John Lopez here, and we're talking about the truly game-changing details that separate some lures from others. Let's get to what truly has been innovative in the soft plastics game. I get this email about, hey, we got some soft plastics. We got some soft plastics that I want you to try. And here I am thinking, oh, great, another person trying to get into the soft plastics game, which is so competitive. It is. And I'll be danged, as I said earlier, you know, I'm throwing them and I have this moment where I see a big speckled trout. We, you know, target in our bay systems, speckled trout, redfish, flounder, you know, maybe some of the near shore stuff, kingfish, et cetera, but specifically to the bays. And I remember this one moment where I'm throwing, I think it was the jerk shad, and I see a nice speckled trout, you know, kind of go by and then turn around and attack it. And I'm like, well, that's different. You know, I'm thinking, well, that's different. The scent helps, the action, the engineering, to your point. But before we get to that, what in the world possessed you to say, I'm gonna get into the near shore and inshore soft plastic game?
Well, I think it's that diversity of fishing growing up in Australia. And to be honest, it was always kind of the plan to, you know, do the sort of offshore hard baits, you know, basically set up the range of hard baits that were what we were known for in Australia. So the offshore charter fishery, the sort of business plan was, okay, get into hard baits, offshore stuff. We'll get into the sort of inshore, you know, what we call estuary inshore fishery in Australia, and obviously do the same thing in the US. So that was always my plan, because I've always had a, you know, personal interest in all of, you know, whether it's soft plastics or offshore hard baits or whatever, basically all kinds of fishing. And, you know, the thing that I really get excited about with lures is, you know, when you're trying to sort of design these shapes and lures, it's looking at the action that you can get out of it. Because like I said, the, you know, 20 years of watching the way that fish react to lures, you really understand that the details matter a lot with lures. So, you know, like a paddle tail soft bait is, you know, there's a million paddle tails out there, but obviously getting something that's got the right action, the right body roll, that works at the right speed, has the right profile, obviously the scent, the material, all that sort of stuff makes a difference. But that's, you know, that's the sort of thing that I get a bit of a kick out when you're designing these things. You look at them in the tank. But, you know, the inshore stuff to me was just kind of the natural progression of Nomad as, I guess, making lures. It was the next, you know, the next challenge, the next thing to look at. And I suppose we, you know, we did go into it with a focus, you know, the US inshore fishery is obviously a massive market, but I've, you know, spent time catching redfish and speckled trout and snook and all that sort of stuff. Love it. You know, it's an amazing fishery over there in the Gulf and, you know, on the east coast of Florida, catching snook, all that sort of stuff. I love it. So it was sort of a natural progression to get into that for us and not just say, hey, we're going to do offshore trolling minnows and, and whatever. So for me, it was just, you know, I think the common thing that I've seen over the years, whether you're fishing, you know, inshore Gulf for redfish or you're fishing in the Amazon or you're fishing in Australia, a lot of predatory fish have the same sort of behaviours and they react in similar ways. Doesn't matter what species they are. So if you can get certain actions and, you know, you get the lure to do the right thing, for a lot of predatory species, you know, there's things about body roll and, you know, the sort of, the action of the bait, you know, with the jerk shad you're talking about. So the, you know, the tentacles, you know, the kind of the legs off the back of it, the little details that you put on there, to the subtle movement that you can get in a bait is really what makes the difference a lot of the time when the fish are a little bit shy or they, you know, they're pressured. The same things that I was watching for years in the Coral Sea, because, you know, there's plenty of fish in the Coral Sea where we're fishing, but there would be days when, you know, the fish just don't want to bite every day. That's the reality. It doesn't matter where you're fishing. And the differences in the action of the lure and the way you retrieve the lure and even, you know, down to the type of rod you're using to put the action into the lure, all of those things make a really big difference to how many fish you catch at the end of the day. So, but yeah, hopefully, I don't know if that kind of answered the question. About
no, this is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. I will say this, and I want to know just on a personal level, if you've, anybody's ever told you this. The other one that I like is the Wingman, and we're going to get into the engineering here in just a second. But when I opened the dozer and I smelled it, I said, that smells like fried chicken. Has anybody ever told you that it smells like fried chicken?
I haven't had anybody say that it's fried chicken. It's a scent that we did get some advice off a scientist in Australia about the sort of scent that we needed to combine, but it's supposed to be sort of a squid-based scent, so I haven't heard fried chicken, but well, I gotta say there is something about the scent that's a little bit, this is going to sound kind of sick, but it's a little bit addictive, like when you start
playing, my gosh, yes.
It's
the fried chicken. When we get off of this, I want you to put your nose in a bag of, of the dozer, I think, and you tell me if it doesn't smell like fried chicken. It does.
You probably put that in my head now. Every time I pull out a dozer and go fishing, fried chicken.
but let's get into the engineering, because the wingman, the engineering on that, I'm looking at it, and just full disclosure here, you know, my preference right now has been the dozer and the jerk squid, just because I've caught more fish. The Wingman looks like the engineering that went into that, and that's going to be my launch point into what the engineering was on all these, because you mentioned the action on the tails, the roll, which is very key. How did that all come about? What was that? You, was it your team? How did that all come? Because the engineering.
I guess a lot of that stuff. You know, we've got myself and a couple other guys that work on all this sort of stuff. But the way a lot of these lures start, it'll be just an idea. So, you know, I guess to talk through the process, it's like, okay, we're making a range of soft plastics. What type of body shapes do you need that, you know, people, because the reality is we can design all sorts of like weird and crazy looking things, but they need to be familiar enough to fishermen that they're like, oh, I understand what that is. I can look at it on the shelf and be like, oh, that's a jerk shad. Oh, it's a little bit of a different take on a jerk shad. So the concept is we need a jerk shad. It's a common standard, you know, profile that everybody likes to fish. So how do we make a jerk shad that's got the right action, looks good, all that sort of stuff? And that's the sort of premise. So, you know, I'll start out sketching a shape and just think, all right, well, I want the top of it. Maybe it's got to have like a flat head and sort of like little hard edges on the side. So there's all sorts of little things you can design into baits to get the action that you want. So for example, like you might look at the wingman or the double down, essentially sort of different versions of jerk shads. The double down's been designed with the legs sort of separated and kind of poking out the side a little bit more, but they've both got kind of a fairly flat head on them with sort of hard edges on the top. So that, that sort of flat top and the hard edges will get you sort of, you know, when you're flicking it and you want it to jump to the bottom, that'll get it to sort of dart side to side. So you start with these sort of things and then you think, all right, well, the wingman's got little, I guess, little winglets on the side of the leg. So they're the sort of things that create that little bit of detail. So the legs on the wingman or the double down will actually get extra turbulence in them. So you won't even notice it when you're using, you know, the bait. But if you just let it sink to the bottom and kind of sit there, just any sort of like natural water movement, the legs will just kind of like waft around. And that's probably what, you know, that sea trout you were talking about before, that sort of thing. Often those little details, it's the way that the bait will actually move when it's, you don't even kind of know that you're doing it. It's that natural movement in the water of, so the legs on the wingman have got, you know, little nodules on the end of them. So you look at those and think, oh, why are they there? Well, they're there for a reason, because they create extra movement in the tail, that it's that subtle movement. It's not when you're flicking it and it, you know, it's swimming around really fast. Yeah. That's the sort of thing that attracts the fish's attention. So a fish will be sort of looking at it and it sees it and it's darting around. And sometimes a fish will just come and like eat it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, that sea trout you're talking about, the bait just kind of goes a bit slower. You're working it slower on the bottom and the fish is like, oh, something, it triggers something in that fish. But it's that subtle movement. So that's sort of the, you know, I guess the design process. It starts out with, literally starts out, you know, I sketch all this stuff on my iPad and then, you know, it turns into 3D drawings. We sort of do a 3D drawing, then we make samples, we test it in the water, we, you know, tune the action. So a lot of these things will go through a lot of iterations of testing. But yeah, it essentially starts with an idea in your head about what you want the action to be and, you know, what's the concept behind it.
But it's funny, that's just a very complicated step one. How do you get through the rest of the process? Let's talk about it next, right here on the Bite Me Fishing Show on Sports Radio 610. Welcome back with Naaman Olsen, live from outside Brisbane, Australia, here on the Bite Me Fishing Show. You were talking about the idea and getting the design, but the then leg. You got to go to molds. Then you have to go to molds, and that is exactly. A big, big cost, and that's something that a lot of people building lures, you can do it in one mold, but I'm guessing you've got so many that you've gone through.
We've got a lot, and it's, you know, it's part of the process that you obviously, before you make the final mold, you've done a lot of testing. You know, we'll get 3D printed samples done. Then we've got there's like a temporary mold that you can make that's not the final manufacturing mold, and that's where you sort of, you know, you can make that, test all the actions. But that's the part of it I obviously really enjoy, is the sort of, you know, the testing and the iterations of, oh, this different shape does this, and you know, it's surprising how many of the sort of, I guess, design principles from the offshore baits you can apply to inshore baits. And, you know, that crossover is a real thing in terms of action, because, you know, it doesn't matter. Obviously, a wahoo and a redfish are, you know,
sure,
very, very different fish, but there's certain things that will trigger both of those. You know, obviously, redfish aren't going to go and attack a trolling lure at 10 knots, but, you know, There's similarities in the sort of design concepts behind the lures that sort of hold across all of these species, I guess. But one other thing I was going to mention with the wingman, just sort of zip my head there, but one of the design principles we found with the wingman and the double down, so with the squid treks, so that's obviously sort of like an offshore, I mean, smaller sizes on the squid treks that are actually great on sea trout and redfish. But the point of bringing up the squid treks was that in the course of like designing and building that lure, we found that the two longer tentacles that hang off the back of the squid treks were something that trigger bite. So when you're fishing the squid treks, you can actually fish it essentially dead in the water with literally no rod movement. So one of the techniques with the squid treks is lift it up, you kind of jig it, it vibrates, and then you can just stop it dead in the water and those tentacles just kind of like wafting around, just with the bait just sitting there doing nothing at all, will often trigger the bite. So the vibration will attract the attention and those tentacles trigger the bite. So we realized with that squid trex that those tentacles just kind of like the little subtle movement is often what triggers the fish to eat it or not eat it. So we incorporated that same thing into the wingman and the double down. So that was an example of saying, well, how can we make a jerk shad that behaves jerk shad, but it's also got some, I guess, some extra fishes that are going to get, you know, get you more bites and catch more fish.
Well, it's fascinating because the other thing, and I won't keep you, I know we're kind of up against it here, but just a couple more things, is it's dummy proof. And if you want to enter, if you want to enter the soft plastic game or the artificial lures game, you can cast it and you can reel it or you can stop it. And that is, it's a great entry point because also there's also the scent as well. So it's a good sort of entry point for artificials, right?
Absolutely. It really is. And that's one of the key things that I've always tried to design into every lure is that you can just fish it straight out of the packet and it's easy. You know, I like to try and build things into lures where, you know, whether you're a first time fisherman, because I get a real kick, you know, even kids going out fishing, using these things for the first time, like, you know, that was part of the attraction with charter fishing was you'd get guys that come out catching their first fish. So you've got all experience levels from, you know, beginners to guys that have been doing it their whole life, but trying to design baits where you can literally just grab it. I mean, obviously the soft plastics, you know, you got to rig them on a jig head, but all the hard baits, the concept was make products that you can just literally open the box, tie it on, go fishing, and you're going to catch fish. And that, you know, that applies to the designs with all of the soft plastics, really, that, you know, like I said, the dozer, the idea there, you can impart all sorts of action to it, but the idea is you just cast it out. As long as you can turn the handle, you're going to catch fish.
That's awesome. One more thing here for you. What's on the horizon? What can we expect? Because it is very, it's doing quite well, at least in my neck of the woods, our listeners and what I've thrown. What's coming up for our types of fishermen?
Yeah, look, there's definitely some new body shapes. I've actually got it on the, I've got a drawing sitting on my iPad at the moment. Some, I guess, sort of crustacean type shapes that we're looking at for the live ops range. But yeah, there's a lot of new shapes that we've got coming. So the plan is to obviously add to the live ops range. We're also looking at a lot of, you know, custom rigging options just to make, you know, the fishing a little bit easier to, you know, to rig. So we've sort of launched the range of baits. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of rigs that we're working on and ways to rig and fish these things just to make them easier to fish out of the packet. And obviously we're still, you know, still working on offshore lures. We've got a few new shapes coming through, but there's a lot of new products in the pipeline that, you know, myself and the rest of the team over here are working on and, you know, be traveling. Actually, I'll be over in the US in August. We'll be, you know, specifically focused on sort of Florida and the Gulf, going around there, doing some fishing and visiting a few tackle stores. So, you know, go over there regularly and, you know, get some exposure to the fishery. But no, we're pretty excited about where live ops has gotten to at the moment. And, you know, I guess the future of being more involved in, you know, new products in that inshore saltwater fishery in the US, it's, you know, it's a fishery I really love. I think you guys got a, you know, that flats fishing, redfish, sea trout, it's a great fishery. You know, I've really enjoyed, you know, fishing in a lot of areas in the Gulf over the years. So looking forward to doing more of it and making some more baits.
Well, you got a spot on my boat if you come down here anytime you want, and I'm all about R&D too. If you ever need any guinea pigs,
it's a really fun part of it.
Yeah. All right, Damon. Oh, by the way, how many stores are you in right now here on the Gulf Coast? Our podcast really covers the entire country, but largely Florida all the way down to the tip of Texas.
Yeah, I haven't even looked in the Gulf. I mean, I think the coast of the US, we're in around about 500 odd retail stores at the moment. So, you know, obviously we're in some of the bigger chains as well. But, you know, the local retailers are a real focus for us. And I know we've had some great support. There's a lot of great stores on the Gulf Coast that that range the live ops product. And, you know, I've got a great team of sales reps out there as well. Working on getting them into some of the stores, but you know, anyone listing that hasn't got them in their local store, definitely worth checking them out.
Yeah. Well, all right, man. Really appreciate it. We'll do it again at some point when you're not catching a million fish.
Sounds good. Appreciate it, John. Thanks for the time. And hopefully I'll see you over there sometime soon.
Yes, sir.
You never know. You never know. He's visiting the U.S. in late August. And you know what else is in late August? The Bite Me Feeding Frenzy. Wouldn't that be cool? All right. Fun stuff. Glad you guys could join us. Hope you have a great weekend. Hey, there should be some windows out there. We'll see you tomorrow, 4 a.m. here on the Bite Me Fiction Show. Until then, you guys have a great Saturday. Great rest of your weekend. Catch them up. We'll talk to you next time.